Mary, Queen of Scots. It was in the month of December, 1542, when grim winter held all the land of Scotland in its iron grip, and a storm of trouble swept the country, more fierce even than the wintry blasts, that a royal baby first saw the light in the old castle of Linlithgow. "Is it a lad?" asked the people anxiously of one another. So much depended on that baby. He was to be their future king and deliver their land from the English oppressor. The hopes of all the country were centered on the child. But alas, it was no future king that was feebly wailing in the nursery of the old palace. "It's a pure wee lassie," was the news that passed from mouth to mouth, and there were looks of bitter disappointment and sad foreboding. With all the haste, the news was carried to the dying King James V at Falkland, and when he heard of the birth of his little daughter, he too had no welcome to give her. He had hoped with all his heart that he might have a son to carry on the Stuart line and rule the kingdom he was leaving. "It came with a lass," he said slowly and sorrowfully, "and it will pass with a lass." He was thinking how it was through Marjorie Bruce that the Stuarts just came to the throne, and it seemed but an ill omen that the crown should now pass to another lass. Perhaps the bitter disappointment hastened the king's end, for it was but an hour or two later that he died, and the little fatherless baby at Linlithgow became Queen of Scotland. Then arose a storm of tongues, and a host of plots and plans raged round the cradle of the tiny queen. Some wanted one thing and some another. Henry VIII of England, her father's uncle, wanted her kingdom as well as herself, and began at once to plot how he might secure both. The Earl of Arran, the next heir to the throne, wanted to have the child completely under his care. So they all plotted and quarreled, and meanwhile the queen mother, Mary of Lorraine, held the baby safely in her arms and refused to be parted from her. Enemies might gather round, but they had little chance of harming the child when her mother's watchful care surrounded her. It was rumored then that the baby was sickly and likely to die, but well might the nurse, Janet Sinclair, deny with scorn such idle tales. The child was as healthy as a child could be. She was as fair and sweet as a flower, and the pride of Janet's heart. In the sunniest, warmest rooms of the old palace, facing the lake, the royal baby grew and thrived, caring not a jot for the storms that raged around her. When the nobles of her realm came to render to her their homage and to hail her as their sovereign lady, Mary, Queen of Scotland and the Isles, their presence did not greatly disturb Her Majesty as she lay warm and contented on her nurse's knee. The next great state ceremonial, however, was not at all to her taste. It had been considered safer to take the child to Stirling Castle, where she could be securely guarded from foes at home and abroad, and here, 9 months later, her coronation was celebrated. Little Mary was dressed in queenly robes, which doubtless harassed her greatly, and carried in state by her lord keepers and other nobles across the green to the stately church. There she was solemnly crowned and presented to the people as their sovereign lady. It was such a big crown for such a tiny head, and the baby's hand could not grasp the heavy scepter, while the sword of state was bigger than the little sovereign lady herself. The throne on which she was held was cold and comfortless, and it is little wonder that she cried and protested loudly. She wanted her mother and Janet, her nurse. These great rough men could not know how to hold a baby properly. She did not like the crowd of faces, and the noise frightened her. Then no one seemed to mind whether she cried or not, and she had to sit on that uncomfortable throne while every prelate and peer of the realm knelt before her and, placing a hand upon her head, swore to serve her truly and loyally. She was even kissed by her two kinsmen, Arran and Lennox, and that, perhaps, was worst of all. "It is an evil sign," said the people, shaking their heads solemnly, as their queen wept and wailed bitterly all through her coronation. Poor little queen, There were always people ready to blame her, even when she did what every other child in her realm would have done under the same circumstances. So the baby's head was crowned in state, and her portrait was struck off on a little copper coin, which was called a bobby, perhaps because of the baby face upon it. Now the King of England did not at all approve of this coronation, and he was furiously angry because all his plots had come to naught. He had planned that the little Queen of Scotland should marry his son Edward and be brought up in England, but the Queen Mother had different plans, and it was no easy matter to storm the good old castle of Stirling and carry away the baby by force. Cunning, too, was of little avail, for the Queen was loyally guarded by her Lord Keepers, who had wise heads as well as faithful hearts. "We demand to see the Queen," said the Earl of Angus, riding up to the castle with a strong company of his followers behind. "It is rumored that she hath been removed and another child substituted, and we must see with our own eyes if this be so." The Lord Keepers watched the armed men pressing forward, but they answered calmly and courteously that the request should be granted. Only the rule of the castle was that but one man at a time should enter the castle gate, be presented to the queen, and that in the presence of her Lord Keepers and guards. The plan had been to seize the child as soon as Angus and his followers were admitted into the castle, and their looks of rage and disappointment when their plan came to naught must have warned the Lord Keepers to be more than ever on their guard. The outside storm swept on, and Mary's kingdom was laid waste by the invading English, while men quarreled continually as to who should be the future husband of the little queen. And all the time the little maiden herself grew like a rose in a sheltered garden, gradually unfolding its petals and growing more lovely day by day. There were other flowers, too, in that sheltered garden. Four other little Maries, her playmates and maids of honor. Together they learned their lessons and stitched their pieces of embroidery, and together they played their games, as if the world was full of sunshine and no dark clouds of war and misery hung over the land. But the storm of war drew closer, and it was thought safer for a while the little queen should leave the stronghold of Stirling Castle and take refuge in the priory of Inchmahom, a little island in the Lake of Monteith. From there she could easily escape to the highlands if the English army advanced on Stirling. Mary was 5 years old at that time and was a very charming child. She seemed to have the gift of making everyone love her, and even the rough fishermen of the lake, who saw her playing on the shore with her four Maries, watched her with love and loyalty in their eyes, and she ruled as a veritable queen over their hearts. Dressed in black silk with a gay tartan scarf and her shining golden hair bound with a rose-colored satin snood, she made a pretty picture for her loyal subjects to gaze upon as she and her maids of honor held a mimic court on the little island. 5 years was no great age, but yet Mary was already learning history, geography, and Latin, and could speak French as well as English. She was learning, too, how to sew tapestry and to embroider. But while the little queen was safely learning her lessons and playing her games at Inchmahom, the queen mother was anxiously arranging fresh plans for her little daughter. She was a Frenchwoman, and through all those years of trouble and anxious fears, her heart had always turned to her own dear land of France. And now she decided that little Mary should be sent there, and that when she was old enough, she should marry the young Dauphin Francis. It was very hard to part with the child, but it seemed to be the best and only way. Everything was made ready as secretly as possible, for although Henry VIII was now dead, the English were still anxious to carry off the little queen, and it was impossible to set sail from Leith, for the English fleet was guarding the fort. So Mary and her maids of honor and all her court and guardians were taken to Dumbarton, and waited there until the French galleys arrived to carry her over to France. It was a very sad little child with tear-stained face that set sail that day. She was leaving her mother and going off to an unknown land, and everything felt sad and strange to her. but although only 6 years old, she showed that she was a Stuart and a queen, and she bore herself with gallant self-control. Only the tears in her eyes spoke of a very sore little heart as she bade her mother goodbye. It might have been hoped that gentle winds and kindly weather would make the voyage as pleasant as possible for the little desolate queen. But instead of that, a most terrific storm arose, and Lady Fleming, the queen's governess, began to wonder if they would ever see land again. But at last, after days of tossing, a haven was reached, and the little Scotch queen and all her court were landed on the coast of Brittany. As soon as they were able, they went at once to Morlaix to return thanks to the cathedral there for their escape from the perils of the sea and from the hands of the English. It happened that as they were returning from the city, the drawbridge over which the little queen had just passed gave way, and there was a scene of great terror and confusion as it crashed down into the river beneath. It was enough to frighten any child, but Mary was perfectly calm and showed no sign whatever of fear. It was this fearless spirit of hers which so charmed her Uncle Francis, Duke of Guise. "My niece," he said to her, "there is one trait in which, above all others, I recognize my own blood in you. You are as brave as my bravest men at arms. If women went into battle now, as they did in ancient times, I think you would know how to die well." Journeying on to the castle of Saint-Germain, Mary was welcomed there by the little French princes and princesses, and saw for the first time the dauphin who was to be her future husband. The two children soon became good friends, and as they were about the same age, they learned their lessons together and were taught their dancing steps by the same master. Dancing came very easily to the graceful little queen, and it was not long before she and her small partner were called upon to dance before the king and queen and the whole court. It was perhaps impossible to avoid bringing the child forward, for she had exactly the gifts which best fitted her to shine in such a court, and she attracted notice wherever she went. But the great sheltered life in the old gray castle of Scotland must have been a healthier and better training for the little maid. The brilliant court of France was scarcely the best place in which to bring up a child. Janet, the Scotch nurse, did not greatly love the change and must have often shaken her wise head over these foreigners and their ways. They tried at first to part her from her charge, but that was no easy matter, and she soon showed that she was not a person to be lightly set aside. So 2 years passed by, and then came the joyful news from Scotland that the Queen Mother was about to return to France for a short time to visit her little daughter. Mary's delight knew no bounds, and she wrote at once to her grandmother, the Duchess of Guise, to tell the good news. "My lady," she wrote, "I'm very glad to be able to offer you these present lines for the purpose of telling you the joyful tidings which I have received from the Queen, my mother, who has promised me by her letters dated the 22nd of April to come over very soon to see you and me, and for us to see her, which will be to me the greatest happiness that I could desire in this world. And this rejoices me to such a degree as to make me think I ought to do my duty to the utmost in the meantime, and study to become very wise, in order to satisfy the good desire she has to see me, all you and she wish me to be." The coming, so much looked forward to, was delayed for some months, and gave the little queen time to try and grow wise as she had planned. But at last the happy day arrived. How the child must have longed to run and meet her mother, to throw her arms around her neck and feel the kisses she had missed so sadly. But the meeting was a state affair, and Mary had to remember she was a queen first and a daughter afterwards. She read the address of welcome that had been prepared for her, and inquired solemnly into the affairs of her kingdom with a graciousness and dignity that sat quaintly on a child of 8 years old. And it was small wonder that everyone was delighted with her. The only wonder was that her little head was not turned by all the praise and admiration showered upon her. Childhood's days of happy unconsciousness were but short ones for this little Queen of Scotland. Far too early she knew the cares and troubles that gather round the head that wears a crown. She still had many hours of childish joy, days in the forest hunting and hawking, fetes at court, and many a merrymaking, but the weight of the crown was always there, and each year brought fresh responsibilities. After that one happy visit, she never saw her mother again, and that must alone have been a sure grief to her faithful little heart. She was not a child to forget easily, and those who loved had their place very deep in her heart. She was carefully thoughtful for all those who served her, and never failed to help them when it was in her power. Many a letter she wrote to the Queen Mother, reminding her how faithful the good Janet had been, and begging for some favor to be bestowed upon her. The childish face of the little queen, so full of charm and beauty, began very soon to wear a grave and thoughtful expression. Her eyes that gazed so earnestly out to the future had often a wistful look in them, for her life, even at 12 years of age, was not a very easy one. What did the future hold for her? Brilliant days of happiness, perhaps, many triumphs, and surely many cares. But who can look into the future? It is hidden from all mortal eyes, and was hidden then, thank God, from the wistful, innocent eyes of Scotland's child queen.